Welcome to the History AI Podcast, where the past comes alive with facts, anecdotes, and a dash of humor. Here are your hosts, Chuck and Marco.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the History AI Podcast, the show where the past isn't dusty, it's debugged. I'm Chuck.
And I'm Marco. Today we're diving into the 1894 Pullman strike, one of the most explosive labor showdowns in U.S. history. Trains stopped, the mail stalled, a president sent in troops, and a future presidential candidate went to jail. Light stuff.
Sip your coffee. Maybe put the cat somewhere safe. We're going to talk company towns, wage cuts, injunctions, and why a fancy sleeping car helped set the country on fire.
And quick reminder, our episodes are evergreen. You can listen in any order and they'll still make sense. We also power this show with the latest AI architecture, which keeps us efficient and fact-checked across sources while we write and record all that, so you get a clear story without the fluff. Also, stay tuned after the episode for the original song, The Strike at Pullman Town.
Speaking of clear stories, let's lay the tracks. What exactly was the Pullman strike, and why did it matter?
So let's set the stage. We're in the 1890s, and America is in the middle of what you could call a double-edged boom. On one hand, the country's industrial engine is roaring, railroads crisscrossing the map, steel pouring out of foundries, fortunes being made at a dizzying pace. But on the other hand, that prosperity wasn't evenly shared. For workers, life could be dangerous, exhausting, and incredibly uncertain.
And right in the middle of that comes the Panic of 1893. It was one of the worst depressions the country had ever seen. Railroads collapsed into bankruptcy, factories shuttered, banks went under, and unemployment skyrocketed. People forget just how fragile things were, millions suddenly out of work, and those lucky enough to have jobs often faced massive wage cuts.
Now enter George Pullman. He's not just any industrialist, he's the guy behind the Pullman Palace Car Company. If you've ever seen one of those gleaming, luxury sleeping cars from the Gilded Age, that's Pullman's creation. He made overnight train travel feel like you were in a rolling hotel, complete with velvet curtains and polished wood. He had a reputation for high standards and efficiency, and he wanted his workers to reflect that same polish.
Which is why he built the town of Pullman, just outside Chicago. This wasn't some slapdash workers' housing. It was a carefully planned community, red brick homes, tree-lined streets, a library, even parks. Pullman wanted it to look like a utopian village, the kind of place that would keep workers stable, sober, and productive. He believed he could engineer not just sleeping cars, but also people's lives.
But here's the catch, it was all company-controlled. Workers paid rent to Pullman, bought their groceries at Pullman stores, lived under rules set by Pullman managers. Even the houses were inspected for cleanliness. On paper, it sounded like model living. In practice, it felt like you never got away from the boss, even after you punched out.
And when the Depression hit, that setup became unbearable. Pullman cut wages at the factory, sometimes as much as 30%, but rents and utility costs in the town stayed exactly the same. Workers saw their paychecks shrink to almost nothing, yet the bills didn't budge. That's not just a financial problem, it's a dignity problem. Imagine working all day and finding you've earned just a few dollars after rent is deducted by your employer landlord.
Exactly. Workers started sending petitions to Pullman, asking for relief or at least some kind of negotiation. They weren't even demanding raises, just fairness, lower the rent, or meet us halfway. But Pullman refused to budge. He saw himself as a benevolent father figure, and in his mind, arbitration meant he was giving up authority.
And that refusal is the spark. In May of 1894, with no other options left, the Pullman workers walked off the job. It began as a local strike in a small company town, but the conditions, the symbolism, and the stubbornness of George Pullman set the stage for something much bigger.
Right, because what started in a single factory community was about to spread across the entire country. The Pullman strike was no longer just about one company's wages and rents, it was about the balance of power between workers, corporations, and the federal government.
So once the Pullman workers walked off the job, the big question was, who's going to back them up? On their own, a few thousand employees in one company town didn't have the power to really squeeze the railroads.
That's where Eugene V. Debs enters the picture. Debs was a former railroad fireman who knew the grind of 12-hour days in blistering heat, shoveling coal into an engine. By 1894, he had become the head of the American Railway Union, or ARU. And what made the ARU different from other unions at the time was that it didn't just organize one craft, like engineers or switchmen, it tried to unite everybody working on the rails.
That was pretty radical for the time. Most unions were really picky about who could join, but Debs believed solidarity meant more than just your own trade. If you were on the rails, you were in. And that gave the ARU real muscle.
The Pullman workers knew it. They asked Debs and the ARU for help, and when the union held its national convention in Chicago that June, the delegates debated whether to support them. A lot of people worried it would be risky, going up against a giant like Pullman could backfire. But in the end, they voted overwhelmingly to back the strike.
Their strategy wasn't a violent one, it was a boycott. The ARU announced that its members would refuse to handle any train that carried Pullman cars. It was simple, but devastating. If a train had a Pullman sleeper attached, the switchmen just uncoupled it. If it stayed attached, crews refused to move it.
And here's the thing, Pullman cars were everywhere. They weren't a niche product, they were the bread and butter of passenger rail revenue. So when the boycott took hold, it rippled across the entire country. Suddenly it wasn't just about a factory strike south of Chicago, it was about the rail network grinding to a halt.
And as the boycott spread, the stakes got higher. The railroads weren't about to let this stand. They knew that if trains stopped moving, money stopped flowing. So they came up with a counter move. They attached U.S. mail cars to the trains that had Pullman cars. That meant if workers refused to move those trains, they weren't just boycotting Pullman anymore, they were interfering with the mail.
Which in the eyes of the federal government was a whole different story. The mail was sacred. Interfering with it wasn't just a labor dispute, it was a national problem.
Meanwhile, Chicago was turning into the epicenter of the crisis. Crowds of workers, supporters, and the unemployed filled the streets. At first it was mostly peaceful, but with tempers high and people desperate, clashes with police and rail guards started breaking out. Rail cars were overturned, tracks were torn up, and there were reports of fires.
The irony is, most of the ARU leaders wanted to keep it orderly, but once a movement like that gathers tens of thousands of people, it's almost impossible to control. And by late June, this wasn't just a labor dispute anymore. It was a showdown between workers, railroads, and now, potentially, the federal government. So with the boycott spreading and rail traffic slowing to a crawl, the railroads knew they had to call in some heavyweight backup. And they had just the guy in Washington, Attorney General Richard Olney.
Now Olney's background is key here. Before becoming Attorney General under President Grover Cleveland, he had been a railroad lawyer. He knew the industry inside and out, and let's just say his sympathies didn't exactly lie with the workers.
Right. Olney saw the ARU boycott as more than just a labor action. He argued it was interfering with interstate commerce, and especially with the U.S. mail. And once you frame it that way, it's not just a dispute between a company and its employees, it's a federal problem.
So Olney goes to court and gets a federal injunction. Basically, a legal order that told Debs and the ARU leadership, stop encouraging this boycott, stop interfering with rail traffic, and don't even promote it in speeches or writing.
Debs, of course, didn't see it that way. To him, this was about the right to organize and protest unfair treatment. He thought the injunction was a gag order, an attempt to strip workers of their voice. And he wasn't about to quietly fold.
Which set up the next escalation. With the injunction ignored and trains still blocked, President Cleveland makes his move. Against the wishes of Illinois Governor John Peter Altgeld, who insisted state forces could keep order, Cleveland sent in federal troops to Chicago in early July.
That was a huge flashpoint. Altgeld was furious, saying the president had no right to override a governor's authority. But Cleveland argued that the federal government had to protect the mail and keep commerce flowing.
Once those troops rolled in, the temperature in Chicago went through the roof. Crowds that had been rowdy but mostly restrained turned angrier. Confrontations broke out between soldiers and strikers. Before long, the violence spiraled, rail cars torched, tracks ripped up, clashes leaving people injured and dead.
In Chicago alone, over a dozen people were killed, and across the country the death toll climbed even higher. Hundreds were wounded. What had begun as a dispute over wages and rent in a company town had escalated into one of the most violent labor conflicts in American history.
And when the dust settled, Debs himself was arrested for violating the injunction. He'd refused to back down, and the courts made an example of him. He was sentenced to jail time for contempt of court, and the ARU, still young and not fully established, was crushed under the weight of legal and military pressure.
And maybe just as important as the immediate defeat was the legal precedent. Because the following year, in the case of Henry Debs, the Supreme Court upheld the government's use of injunctions and federal force. They ruled that Washington had broad power to step in whenever interstate commerce or the mail was at risk. That decision would hang over the labor movement for decades.
Exactly. The message was clear: you can strike, but if your strike touches national infrastructure, the federal government can, and will, step in. And it usually won't be on your side. Now, not everyone wanted this to end in violence and court battles. There were real efforts to find a middle ground, to bring both sides to the table. And one of the most interesting voices in all of this was Jane Addams.
Yeah, Addams is best known for Hull House, her pioneering social reform work in Chicago. But during the Pullman strike, she stepped in and tried to mediate. She believed arbitration could solve the conflict, sit everyone down, listen to grievances, find a compromise. She warned that humiliating workers, shutting them out of negotiations, would only breed bitterness.
And she was right. But George Pullman flatly refused to consider arbitration. He was convinced that if he allowed outside voices, or even gave the appearance of yielding, he'd lose control, not just of the strike, but of his entire model town system. To him, authority had to be absolute.
That stubbornness cost him. In the aftermath, the Illinois Supreme Court forced the Pullman Company to give up its residential properties. The so-called model town was dismantled as a company-owned experiment. It turns out people didn't like their boss being their landlord and their mayor. Who knew?
And politically, Cleveland had his own fallout to manage. Sending federal troops into Chicago made him deeply unpopular with labor groups and many ordinary citizens. But here's the twist: just 2 months later, in September of 1894, Congress rushed through a law making Labor Day a federal holiday.
It was a classic political move, a kind of peace offering. On the one hand, Cleveland had crushed the strike with troops. On the other, he wanted to show workers that their contributions were valued. Here's a holiday in your honor, even if the underlying issues of wages and workplace rights were still unresolved.
And in terms of the labor movement itself, the strike was a turning point. The American Railway Union never recovered. It had been young, ambitious, and too bold to survive that level of government opposition. But other organizations, especially the American Federation of Labor, stepped into the vacuum, focusing on smaller, craft-based negotiations that were less likely to provoke national crackdowns.
And then there's Debs. Jail time radicalized him. While behind bars, he read deeply, studied socialism, and came out more convinced than ever that workers needed to fundamentally change the system. Within a decade, he'd be one of the most famous socialist politicians in America, running for president multiple times.
So in the end, the Pullman strike didn't just reshape a company town, it reshaped the labor movement, the law, and even the national calendar. It was a defeat in the moment, but it planted seeds that would grow into bigger movements later on.
Up to now we've been talking about the big picture: railroads, unions, presidents, Supreme Court rulings. But at the heart of the Pullman strike were ordinary workers, and it's worth slowing down to picture what life was actually like for them.
Imagine you're one of those Pullman employees in 1894. You're skilled, you've put in long hours building these elegant sleeping cars, and you take pride in the work. But after the wage cuts, your paycheck is maybe a dollar or two a day. Then Pullman takes rent for your house right out of that paycheck, and suddenly you've got barely enough left to buy food for your family.
And that rent isn't going to some neutral landlord, it's going right back to the company. That meant Pullman was on both sides of the equation, paying you less while still collecting the same from you every month. It was a no-win situation for workers.
And it wasn't just about the math. It was about dignity. Workers felt trapped. They couldn't say, "Fine, I'll move to cheaper housing, because all the housing in town was Pullman's. They couldn't shop around for groceries, because the stores were Pullman's. Their whole lives were wrapped inside this company bubble.
Right, and even if you kept your lawn neat and followed all the rules, you still felt like you were being treated like a tenant child, not an independent adult. When wages were cut, it wasn't just a pay issue. It was a question of respect, whether Pullman saw his workers as human beings with families to feed or just as moving parts in his industrial machine.
And for families, that stress was crushing. Mothers trying to stretch grocery money that just wasn't there. Kids growing up knowing the household was on the edge. Workers weren't striking just to make a few more cents an hour, they were striking because their sense of fairness, their sense of control over their own lives, was being stripped away.
And here's the irony. George Pullman had built his town with the idea that he was giving workers a better life, shielding them from the grime and chaos of Chicago. But in reality, when the hard times came, that very control, the company houses, the company stores, turned what might have been a simple wage dispute into something far more personal, even existential.
That's the part of the story I always come back to. You can talk about injunctions and national boycotts, but at the end of the day, the Pullman strike was fueled by men and women who wanted something pretty basic: to work hard, earn a fair wage, and live without feeling trapped by the very company that signed their paychecks. So let's step back and ask, what does the Pullman strike actually teach us? Because it's more than just an old labor dispute, it's a case study in how power works in America.
Yeah, one of the clearest lessons is about infrastructure. Railroads were the lifeline of the entire economy in the 1890s. If trains didn't move, nothing moved: mail, goods, people, all of it. Workers figured that out, and they used it as leverage. But the flip side is, when you mess with the nation's arteries, you guarantee a big reaction.
Which leads straight into the second lesson: the law itself was a battlefield. The government wasn't neutral. By using injunctions, by framing the boycott as an attack on commerce and the mail, the courts gave management a powerful weapon. Workers weren't just fighting Pullman, they were fighting the federal judiciary and the Justice Department.
And the third thing, which maybe gets overlooked, is dignity. This wasn't just dollars and cents. Sure, wages mattered, but the deeper wound was about respect. Workers asked for arbitration, just a chance to be heard, and Pullman flat out refused. That silence, that dismissal, made everything worse.
Exactly. And think about how those three things fit together. Infrastructure gave workers power, the law gave employers a counterweight, and dignity, or the lack of it, fueled the passion that kept the strike alive. When you add them up, you see why the Pullman strike exploded the way it did.
And there's one more piece that sticks. Symbols. Out of all this turmoil, we got Labor Day as a federal holiday. It didn't fix the injustice, but it left a permanent mark on the calendar, a reminder that workers matter to the nation's fabric.
That's the strange duality of the Pullman strike. On the ground, it ended in defeat for the workers. But in the long run, it helped define how Americans think about labor, law, and the role of government in disputes between the two. We've mentioned a lot of names along the way, but it's worth pausing to really meet the people who shaped this moment.
Let's start with George Pullman himself. He wasn't just a businessman, he saw himself as a kind of social engineer. The sleeping cars were his masterpiece, but the town was his statement: orderly streets, tidy lawns, rules for everything. He believed that if he built the perfect environment, he'd get perfect workers.
And that belief had a steel edge to it. When things got tough, he held the line. He cut wages because the market demanded it, but he wouldn't cut the rents because his model demanded control. In his mind, compromise looked like chaos.
Now set that against Eugene V. Debs. He came up through the ranks, literally shoveling coal into engines, and he never forgot what that felt like. By the time he led the ARU, he'd become this voice that could turn frustration into solidarity. He didn't see 1,000 separate jobs on the rails, he saw one workforce.
And he had a moral clarity that made people listen. When the injunction came down, he read it as more than a court order, he read it as a message that workers could speak only when it was convenient. That's the line he wouldn't cross, even if it meant jail.
Then there's Richard Olney, the Attorney General. He's the pivot point between the private world of railroads and the public power of the government. With his railroad background, he knew exactly how to frame the conflict in legal terms, interstate commerce, the sanctity of the mail, and he used that framing to bring the courts and the army into the fight.
Which brings us to Governor John Peter Altgeld of Illinois. He's a fascinating counterweight. He believed the state could handle the unrest and that federal troops would make things worse. To him, it was about constitutional boundaries and also about trust, trust that local authorities knew their streets better than Washington did.
And threading through all of this is Jane Addams. She doesn't arrive with bayonets or court briefs, she arrives with the question, "Can we talk?" She believed humiliation was a terrible foundation for peace. If you want people to accept an outcome, you have to let them speak into it.
Put them all together and you get a kind of chorus. Pullman sings about order, Deb sings about solidarity, Olney sings about law and commerce, Altgeld sings about state authority, and Adams sings about empathy. None of them is humming the same melody, which is why the piece becomes a clash instead of a harmony.
And that's the lesson hidden in their personalities. The Pullman strike wasn't just an economic event. It was a collision of worldviews, how to run a business, how to run a government, and how to treat the people who make the whole thing move.
When you hear their voices side by side, you understand why the summer of 1894 played out the way it did. The outcomes weren't inevitable, but they were baked into the convictions of the people making the choices. Let's play with a counterfactual for a minute. What if, back in May of 1894, George Pullman had agreed to binding arbitration?
The temperature probably drops immediately. You still have a bruising negotiation, but now there's a table, there are rules, and there's a timeline. Workers get to make their case, management gets to save face, and maybe everyone walks away with something they can live with.
In that world, the ARU might still show up in solidarity, but it's a supporting role, not the star of a national showdown. Without a boycott that chokes off half the rail system, the railroads don't feel the same urgency to lash everything to the mail and drag Washington into it.
Which means Richard Olney has a harder time convincing a judge that this is an emergency threatening interstate commerce. No emergency, no sweeping injunction, and maybe no federal troops rolling into Chicago with bayonets and blanketed authority.
Debs's story changes too. Instead of a jail cell and a Supreme Court case that turns his name into a legal citation, he might become the architect of a landmark labor compromise, still famous, but for a deal instead of a defiance.
And think about the downstream effects. If the ARU isn't shattered, you could see a stronger industrial union movement take root earlier, shaping contracts on the rails before the progressive era really gets humming. The AFL still grows, sure, but it might share space with a durable, big-tent railway union rather than inheriting the field by default.
On the company side, Pullman's model town might survive in a modified form. If rents budge a little and the rules loosen a lot, the grand social experiment doesn't collapse under court orders and public scorn. It becomes a case study in how paternalism can evolve, or at least learn to knock before entering.
Now let's flip it. What if even with arbitration on the table, the railroads still play hardball and lash mail cars to every Pullman train? You're right back at the federal doorstep, because the second the mail is entangled, the conflict stops being a local dispute and becomes a national obligation.
And once the frame shifts to protect the mail and keep commerce moving, the debate moves from picket lines to courtrooms. You can almost see a different version of Henri Debs still happening, just with more footnotes and fewer fires.
Either way, the thought experiment exposes the hinge of the whole story. Early choices, especially the choice to talk, don't guarantee a happy ending, but they widen the path to one. Refusing to talk narrows that path to a tightrope and then shakes the wire.
So the lesson in the what if isn't that history had to unfold differently. It's that moments of pride and principle, handled without humility, can turn a solvable problem into a national crisis. And once a crisis starts rolling on rails, it's hard to stop. We've kept this story anchored in its time, but you can probably hear the echoes. The questions that rattled the rails in 1894 haven't vanished.
They've just changed their scenery. Instead of sleeping cars and switching yards, think about the systems that move modern life, ports, highways, data centers, delivery networks. When those slow down, everything downstream feels it.
And that puts us right back on familiar tracks. If you work inside critical infrastructure, you have leverage. But the moment that leverage touches the broader public, packages, services, the things people rely on, the pressure to step in comes fast and loud.
which is why the framing matters so much. In Pullman's day, the tipping point was the mail. Today it might be public safety, essential services, or the flow of commerce. Once the argument becomes, protect the system, the room for negotiation shrinks and the appetite for legal muscle grows.
And beneath the policy talk is the human piece that never goes out of date, respect. People will tolerate hard times a lot better than they'll tolerate being ignored. When leaders refuse to sit down, they don't just harden a conflict, they humiliate the people living through it.
That's the quiet lesson I carry from Pullman. You can build the neatest system in the world, perfect schedules, tidy rules, shiny equipment, but if you don't give people a voice inside it, the order you love becomes the spark that lights the fire.
So when we say our episodes are evergreen, this is what we mean. The names change, the technology changes, but the core questions, how we balance power, how we keep vital systems running, how we treat the people who make them run, those stay relevant.
And studying a moment like Pullman isn't about picking sides a century later. It's about sharpening our instincts. When trouble starts, do we reach for the courtroom and the cavalry, or do we start with a table and a clock and the patience to talk?
If the past has a vote, it's usually for the conversation first. Because once a conflict becomes a national emergency, you don't really get to choose the ending anymore.
Exactly. History won't hand us a script for the next disagreement, but it gives us a rhythm. Listen to it, and you've got a better shot at keeping today's echoes from turning into tomorrow's explosions.
So that's the Pullman strike, a wage dispute that became a constitutional moment, a local grievance that turned national, a luxury sleeping car that woke up a country.
If you enjoyed this, remember, all our episodes are evergreen. Hit play on any topic and you'll get a complete story, start to finish. And hey, we've got new merch. Fresh designs, soft tees, and a mug that's basically a commuter car for your coffee. There's a link in the show notes.
We'd also love your help growing the show. Please rate, subscribe, and share the History AI podcast with a friend. And if you've got a moment, a 5-star review really does help more people find us.
Got a topic you want us to tackle? Drop your suggestions on our socials, X, Instagram, Facebook, wherever you hang out. We actually read them, and they often guide our next picks.
Special thanks to you, yes, you, for listening. And thanks to the latest AI architecture under the hood, we can turn dense research into clear, well-paced episodes you can count on any time of year.
For the History AI Podcast, I'm Marco.
I'm Chuck. Until next time, keep your hands off the hot bearings and your history on track.
Shadow of the rail yard, the factory bells did ring, but wages fell like winter snow, while rent stayed in the kings. The workers cried for mercy, for bread to feed their kin, but the bosses barred the window. The hunger settled in. Oh, stand tall, stand strong. Brothers, hear the sound from Chicago's crowded streets to every rail yard town. Raise your voice for justice and let the steel wheels pound. We won't be broken down. That poor man town. They built us homes to live in. They own the very store, but every dollar that we earned came back a dollar more. The panic hit the nation, yet they cut our pay again. So we laid our tools down silent. Stand tall, stand strong. Sisters, join the sound.
streets when the fight had just begun. Huge in debt, he spoke for us. We're stronger when we're one. Though they jailed him for the cause, the spirit carried on. Now Labor Day remembers, though time has washed the pain, the voices of the working poor still echo in the rain. For every hand that builds the world, for every weary brow, the Pullman strike still teaches us the time to stand is now. Raise your voice for justice, let the steel wheels pound. We won't.